From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Hoops are hot in Cleveland, whether the Cavs win or not. Ahead on Only a Game, will the presence of LeBron James save the Cavaliers and the Rockers? Also, why gray shirts have replaced red shirts as the garment of choice for college football recruits, and a report on racism in the Israeli Premier Soccer League. Also ahead on Only a Game, motorsports mavens leave lawns to do laps in lawnmowers.
I think that a man's not supposed to cut grass. Not with a riding lawnmower anyway. Maybe with a push mower. Maybe a push mower, but riding lawnmowers, they're made for racing.
Well, yeah, stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. There have been more attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq today, despite raids on homes around Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit, the site of yesterday's fatal shoot-down of a Black Hawk helicopter. The military believes suspected insurgents were staying at the homes. Witnesses also report seeing a U.S. convoy coming under attack on a road between Fallujah and Ramadi. They say three trucks were set on fire. The International Red Cross is temporarily closing its offices in Baghdad and Basra. A spokesman refused to provide details, except to say the closing comes because of security reasons. The BBC's Johnny Diamond reports.
The Red Cross has been in Iraq for more than two decades. It was here for the Iran-Iraq War, the first Gulf War, and for the American-led invasion. But the deteriorating security situation in Baghdad and Basra, which is much quieter than the capital, is forcing a pullout. The office in Baghdad, wrecked by a bomb just under 2 weeks ago, will not reopen. The one in Basra will close. The office in the northern city of Mosul will remain open. The reasoning is simple. For the organization to do its work, it has to be accessible to the public. But for its staff to be safe from attack, it would need the protection of the American military, something which the organization's president says he is not willing to accept.
The BBC's Johnny Diamond reporting from Baghdad. The Department of Homeland Security is looking into a report that says terrorists might try to hijack cargo planes and then fly them into nuclear power plants or bridges. The threat, initially reported by NBC News, comes from one unidentified source. State and local authorities have been alerted by the Homeland Security officials and the FBI. A spokesman with the Homeland Security Department says cargo companies have additional security measures in place to thwart would-be hijackers. Jurors in the trial of Washington-area sniper suspect John Allen Muhammad had a first-hand look at the car prosecutors say served as a shooting platform for Muhammad and Lee Boyd Malvo. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Jurors, along with lawyers on both sides, the judge and Muhammad himself, were brought to the Virginia Beach jail facility adjacent to the courthouse where they saw the 1990 Chevrolet Caprice. Police officers demonstrated how the rear seat back could be raised, allowing access to the trunk, and jurors saw the small hole cut out of the rear deck where prosecutors say the snipers placed their rifle in preparation for firing. Jurors then returned to the courtroom where they heard testimony from Robert Holmes, an Army buddy of Muhammad's. Holmes testified Muhammad introduced him to Lee Malvo, telling him Malvo was a sniper. He also said Muhammad wanted to build a silencer for his Bushmaster rifle, saying, in Holmes' words, "Imagine the damage you could do." Brian Naylor, NPR News, Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Additional tests on a naval mail sorting station here in the nation's capital have turned up no anthrax bacteria. As a result, the U.S. Postal Service has reopened 11 Washington facilities. This is NPR. Southern California's massive supermarket strike enters its fourth full week Saturday with a bit of hope on the horizon. Both sides have agreed to go back to the bargaining table on Monday. Eric Roy from member station KCRW has this report.
Shoppers, strikers, and almost everyone in Southern California is pretty tired of the whole thing after nearly a month of strikes and lockouts involving Vaughn's, Albertsons, and Ralph's supermarkets. With both sides apparently set in stone regarding health care benefits, there seemed to be no end in sight. But Vaughn's Public Affairs Director Sandra Calderon says word of possible movement came late Friday.
The federal mediator has asked all the sides to resume negotiations. I can confirm that the employers will be meeting with the federal mediator.
Calderon would not elaborate and stressed that neither side will be able to comment on how the talks are going once they start. For NPR News, I'm Eric Roy in Los Angeles.
Pittsburgh hospital officials say one of 185 people who were infected with hepatitis A has died. He caught the deadly liver disease after eating at a Chi-Chi's restaurant some 25 miles northwest of Pittsburgh. All of the 185 cases of hepatitis A are believed to be tied to the Mexican restaurant. Most of the victims are from Pennsylvania, but some are from other states, including Ohio and West Virginia. The defending champion U.S. baseball team will be sitting at home next summer while teams from other countries compete in the Olympics in Athens, Greece. In a stunning defeat, Mexico beat the U.S. 2-1 yesterday. The loss eliminates the U.S. from a qualifying tournament. The Americans were expected to win yesterday's game and possibly become gold medal winners again. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Magic Johnson, Michael Jordan, these, my friends, are names with which the NBA could conjure. How about LeBron James? That's been the question. As the most highly touted and most lavishly compensated rookie in NBA history has played his first handful of games, most conspicuously the one in which his Cleveland Cavaliers faced the Denver Nuggets of Carmelo Anthony on Wednesday night. Joining me now to discuss the impact of LeBron James on Cleveland and on the rest of us is Akron Beacon Journal columnist Terry Pluto. Terry, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hello, Bill.
All the brouhaha surrounding James seemed justified when he scored 25 points and had 9 assists in his NBA debut last week, but since then he's tailed off a little bit, as might be expected. What are folks, in fact, expecting?
Well, depending upon where you are, the NBA wants them to walk on water, obviously. Like you mentioned before, the hype is coming from the league. It's funny. It's like David Stern and some of the others saying, let's not overdo these kids, and yet they have them a part of every single commercial package that's going on. I've been watching LeBron for a long time. His high school, Akron St. Vincent St. Mary's, is 3 miles from where I live, so I've seen him now for 4 years play. He is an incredible physical specimen, Bill. 6'8", 242 pounds, 7% body fat. He never had an uncoordinated moment in his life, I don't think. It's just like the Lord decided I'm going to make a perfect basketball player, and I did. So he did. Now, you know, the NBA is still a man's league, and you could be built like a man, but, you know, you're 18. And the other thing, too, he's on a lousy team. In the last 4 years, their victory totals have gone from 32 to 30 to 29 to 17.
Well, maybe that's an advantage, though. I mean, if they get even 10 games better, he's a success, right?
I would consider that to be the case, but the way the league is promoting him, I think they figure it raised the expectations around Cleveland to, like, they ought to make the playoffs and this type of thing, and I just think that's totally out of line. This is one of the most self-absorbed, dysfunctional group of athletes playing in this town for a long time that he's come to. You know, the neat thing about LeBron, he really is a pass-first player. I mean, he really has that sort of Magic Johnson, Larry Bird look at the court, far more than a Michael thing. But, he's not getting a lot of help out there.
You mentioned the tension between promoting LeBron in such a way that he would sell tickets all over the league mm-hmm. and promoting him so much that expectations would get too high. I gather the owner of the Cavaliers, Mr. Gund, has said, hey, back off a little bit here.
Yeah, he has, but unfortunately, he does is sell everything from a LeBron James jersey to LeBron James coffee mug. So
so don't back off too much.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like back off, but if I can make some money off, it's fine. And I like Gordon, and I know his heart may be in the right place, but, you know, there is a bottom line thing. He's been taking a financial bath for many years, and this year they're anticipating about 12 sellouts and possibly more if the team plays reasonably well. And also, they will be the second highest road team in attendance right behind the Lakers. That's what the league's projections are. I find this unfathomable, Bill, because as much as I've seen LeBron James, and I like LeBron James, it's no knock on LeBron James, he hasn't done anything in the NBA yet.
Well, you mentioned the fact that the Cavaliers have not exactly drawn large crowds, and yet three of the first five games the team has played have been on national TV. Fans enjoying that? Are they waving, doing a lot of hi, mom, stuff like that?
Yes, they are enjoying the attention. In fact, Cleveland doesn't know what to make of it. We're always the underdog. You know, in Cleveland, we sit around complaining how we're never on national TV. And even when our teams are good, nobody pays attention to us. And all we're ever known is for, you know, the 99-yard drive John Elway against us, or the Florida Marlins. You know, Boston fans can relate to this. And 97 Jose Make, they can't lose the lead. Well, suddenly we've got this guy that has become a magnet for attention. So we have to adjust our attitudes to that, to rather than, hey, pay attention to us. It's like, well, don't pay so much attention to us right now. Give us time to grow.
Right. Well, while the Cavaliers are enjoying ticket sales and merchandise sales based on the phenomenon of LeBron, the same can't be said for the Cleveland Rockers, their former sister team in the WNBA. They were averaging 10,000 fans per game at one point, but now it looks as if that team is going to either move or disappear. Operations have been suspended. What happened?
People didn't go to the games, Bill, and that's been the case around all over the WNBA. Pro basketball in the summer, played by women, just didn't seem to take hold, not just in Cleveland, but most cities. Even when you would see some of these numbers of 8,000 or 10,000, very deep discounted tickets, almost free tickets. Mm. It was not a money crowd. Joe Tate, who does the Cleveland Cavaliers games, also does the Rockers. He loves the Rockers and misses them. And that was one of the, he thought expansion was too fast. He thought it was kind of dumb to have for example, Katie Smith, who was a really very good player at Ohio State, playing for Minnesota instead of having regional drafts where she plays for the Rockers. You know, these type of things. But the bottom line is the bottom line, and the bottom line didn't look very good.
Well, maybe the answer, given that LeBron is making enough money so that he probably won't have to take a summer job,
no.
Pull some sort of Tootsie thing, you know, dress him up, get him out there.
You know, that or you just buy the franchise and let him play for free. I mean, I wonder if that would be allowed. That would be interesting. It is an amazing phenomenon, and the kid can be an amazing player, but it's not going to happen right away, and it's certainly not going to happen with the cast that he has around him.
One thing it sounds as if we can safely conclude is that it's more fun to be a basketball writer in Cleveland now than it has been in some time.
You know, as a sports columnist, I write about what people are talking about. I have probably written more columns about the Cavaliers in the last, since LeBron got drafted, or even right before where they had a chance at him, than I did in the previous 4 years combined. And I enjoy writing pro basketball, so that's been a blessing to me.
Terry Pluto is a columnist for the Akron Beacon Journal. Terry, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Bill.
The Denver Nuggets toppled the NBA champion San Antonio Spurs two Wednesdays ago and dethroned a strong Sacramento Kings team 3 days later. The team is currently 3-3. Though it's early in the season, Denver fans hope that Carmelo Anthony, who was only 10 years old during the Nuggets' last playoff appearance in 1995, can help the team reverse its fortune. From Denver, Nancy Greenlease reports.
Everyone is calling them the new Nuggets. There are new players, new sky blue uniforms, and so far, better results. But to be truly born again, these new Nuggets had to dust off some old highlight reels. Before their first game, the team watched the Nuggets of yesteryear, including the 1994 team, as it fought off the Utah Jazz's final shot in a playoff game.
That's the ball game! The buzzer sounds! The Nuggets win it! We're going back to Salt Lake City, Utah!
Guard John Barry, formerly with the Detroit Pistons, said the tape provided a motivating message for his new team.
You're in a franchise here that's been a great basketball tradition for a lot of years, and they just want to get back to that. You know, last year was an embarrassment.
Barry, a 12-year NBA veteran, chuckles that he's become the old man on this team, a surprising change for a fellow who was known for years as the son of Hall of Famer Rick Barry. The sun is rising to the challenge.
I'm very excitable when I'm out on the floor, and I'm going to play hard. And I've been in the playoffs the last 7 years, so I think I know some things about what we need to do, and I think we have a very receptive group.
What's up, Messi City? Tonight, we have the Sacramento Kings in the house. But you know what? There's a new king in this court, and it is your Denver Nuggets. So everybody get up, make some noise!
During the Nuggets' rout of the Sacramento Kings last Saturday, a healthy Marcus Camby put up double digits in points and rebounds, and just before the half, rookie Carmelo Anthony soared to the basket and slammed one home on his way to a 23-point night. The baby-faced teenager who led Syracuse to last year's NCAA championship possesses the poise and almost the polish of a veteran. After the game, Anthony acknowledged that early problems with turnovers were behind him as he heads into the season's second week.
Yeah, my first two games, I was a little bit anxious just to get out there and start my career, but now I settled down, just calmed down, and I mean, I did a good job.
He's doing great. I mean, let's face it, he's a young man. There's a lot of pressure.
Nuggets head coach Jeff Buzdelic realizes that his phenom is a target for tough defense on the court and unlimited marketing opportunities off it. In August, Carmelo Anthony signed a deal with Nike, rumored to be worth $25 million. And Carmelo will soon have his own candy bar with proceeds going to charity. While Melo is a sweet addition, this team has also built a healthy squad around guard Andre Miller and a beefed-up Nikola Skidishvili. However, Denver's true superstar may be its mile-high altitude. Coach Buzdelic promises his players will run and gun it to wear out opponents.
Because we have a lot of players here, we might not have superstars, but we do have a collection of guys. And, you know, when we're doing that, we could be pretty good, decent, and fun to watch. When we're not, we could be the other way.
Fan Gary Martin witnessed last season's Rocky Mountain low. These Nuggets, especially the feisty 5 foot 5 inch Earl Boykins, impressed him.
Well, I expect them to be at least a 500 club. You never know, they might be the surprise team of the year.
For two decades, Martin has followed the Nuggets. He remembers Denver's glory days in the 1980s when the team appeared in 9 consecutive playoffs. That dynasty depended on the colorful coach Doug Moe and his shooting sensation Alex English. But the current Nuggets squad admits that this team is still a work in progress. Brazilian forward Nene, who has dropped his last name and his translator, is definitely fluent in the Nuggets' trouble spots.
The play, shoot, post, defense, these make difference in the game.
What might make the biggest difference of all is the team's refusal to accept last year's disastrous season as a sign of things to come. Again, John Barry.
You know, this is a new group, and that's how I've always approached it. You know, I've been on teams that have won 30, 35 games the year before, and we've turned around and won 50. You know, we're just looking to move forward.
7 new players have joined Carmelo Anthony, giving Denver a chance to revive its flagging franchise. And in some ways, they can't lose. After all, they have nowhere to go but up in the Mile High City. For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenlease in Denver.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Hard to imagine animals racing with greater motivation than that displayed by the running goats of Dar es Salaam in the annual race held each year at this time in Tanzania. The races, each featuring 60 of the speediest available goats, are part of a charity event which raises money for water and farming projects in one of the world's poorest nations. The owners of the winning goats get to decide the fate of their animals. The losers are roasted and eaten. Among the owners of a winner in last weekend's competition was Jorg Sohn, who said after the race his goat had won, "I am incredibly happy. We will try to enter this one in another race or take it home."
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. Yesterday in Panama City, the U.S. Olympic baseball team lost 2-1 to Mexico, a loss that eliminates them from the Olympic qualifying tournament with no second chances. The U.S. team was unbeaten going into its quarterfinal matchup against previously winless Mexico in the America's qualifying event. The defending champion U.S. baseball team will be at home next summer, while countries like the Netherlands and Italy compete for an Olympic medal in Athens. The Americans would have been among the favorites to win in Greece. There was even a chance future Hall of Famer Roger Clemens would have pitched for them. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston. ¶¶
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, new recruiting strategies for college football programs, or the loophole changes color. But first, 3 years of a bloody intifada have taken hundreds of Israeli and Palestinian lives and fostered increasing mistrust between Israel's Arab and Jewish citizens. Despite this, the soccer pitch continues to be one of the better integrated areas of Israeli society, even if everywhere else in the stadium isn't. Reporter Nahani Rouse attended a recent match between two rival teams in the Israeli Premier League, and she has this report.
Beit She'an Soccer Stadium in Israel's Jordan Valley offers a stunning view of Jordan's Moab Mountains. But on this day, the mountains are a backdrop to a couple hundred young Arab men dancing and singing Allahu Akbar, God is great, and to a thousand or so young Jewish men pounding the bleachers and screaming, Death to the Arabs. The two groups are separated by metal fences, which the most zealous try to climb until police armed with machine guns pull them down. Today's match is between Beitar Jerusalem, the only team in Israel's Premier League never to hire an Arab player, and Ahi Nazareth, which this season earned the distinction of becoming one of the first teams from an Arab city to make it to Israel's top league. To make the atmosphere even more tense, Jerusalem and Nazareth are battling to avoid last place in the league. In the dusty parking lot, a group of Nazareth fans, teenage boys with green soccer jerseys, spiked hair, and dark eyes, lean on cars and complain about the heat and Beitar fans.
It's known they're not the nicest team, but it makes for more action, more experiences. When we play against a team where the fans have no problem with Arabs, for example, against Tel Aviv, it's a little boring if all the teams are the same. But when there is a team like Beitar that represents maybe 50% of the population of Israel, it's the reality here in Israel.
In a separate corner of the parking lot, Beitar fans greet each other affectionately, hugging and patting each other on the back. But for their yellow jerseys, Beitar fans are indistinguishable from Nazareth fans, except when they speak.
What do we think about Ahi Nazareth? The place for them is not here. They should go play in Jordan, not here, if they want a country. And they should make them a league there. They're not Israelis, they're Arabs. We're Jews. It's not possible to be together.
Inside the stadium, Beitar fans sing, This is the land of Israel, it's the land of the Jews, I hate you Arabs. They chant, War, 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 terrorists, terrorists. The anger on the Beitar side grows as Nazareth scores to take the lead for good. Nazareth fans go wild, singing, God is great, and in Hebrew, what's wrong with you, Beitar? Nazareth's game-winning goal is scored by Alon Mizrahi, one of the leading goal scorers in the history of Israeli soccer, a Jewish Israeli, and a former Beitar player. Beitar fans shout, Mizrahi, you traitor, you converted to Islam. One spectator stands out among the Beitar teenagers. Yossi is a middle-aged, balding man who volunteers as an undercover monitor of fan behavior. A nonprofit organization called the New Israel Fund recently began publishing ratings of racist and violent fan behavior in all the major Israeli newspapers. Beitar consistently appears at the top of the list.
The repertoire of the crowds of Beitar Jerusalem have a lot of anti-Arab songs, and they are using it again and again and again throughout years. To take those songs away from them, it will take time. Right now, if you will read the papers, and you will see that the media is against Beitar. They perceive it as something that they should be proud about, meaning the notion of a clean atmosphere is not there yet, and it will take time.
Some feel the New Israel Fund's program has succeeded in shaming other fan clubs into better behavior. Chaim Bar-Am writes about sports and politics for Jerusalem's weekend paper, Kol Ha'ir. He says the atmosphere won't change until there are Arab players on every team.
The focus that has to be captured in order to change things is Beitar. It's more important to change things in Beitar than to change things in any other team. And this would change the attitude here, exactly as it changed them in Al-Presis.
This week, Beitar coach Eli Ohana was quoted in a leading newspaper as saying the team wouldn't hire an Arab player just to say they hired an Arab player. He claims there have never been Arab players available to fit the positions his team needed. There are Arab players on every other Israeli Premier League team now, and Arabs play on Israel's national team. But it wasn't always that way.
What is there today is nothing compared with what it was.
Rifat Turk is Israel's Jackie Robinson. He started playing for Tel Aviv in 1972 and played professionally in Israel for 20 years. He developed lifelong friendships with his teammates, but was verbally abused by fans of opposing teams.
I was alone, and also I was dark. Wherever I went, I stood out. The fact that I succeed to play well opened the way for Arab players that play today. It is much more comfortable for them. Now, on almost every team, there are Arab players. It's legitimate. It's part of the game.
Turk says even 30 years ago, Beitar Jerusalem fans treated him the worst. But he boasts that he scored more goals against Beitar than against any other team.
Just like they knew how to swear at me like baboons behind the fence, like animals. I didn't swear at them or do anything to them. I was on the field playing, scoring goals and causing them grief.
Turk played for Israel's national team for 10 years and competed in the 1976 Olympics in Montreal. Now, he's a deputy mayor in Tel Aviv, Jaffa, Israel's largest municipality. He has opened a new community center in Jaffa and coaches a team of Arab and Jewish kids. He sees the soccer field as a potential common ground.
I'm 1,000,000% sure that through sports you can make life better. Put money into sports and sports will do the work itself. When Jewish players go to play with Arab teams, their relationships will be better. They will visit each other. Their mothers and fathers will watch the kids play, and one will begin to be friends with the other.
Israeli professional soccer has a long way to go before it can help transform Israeli society the way Rifat Turk believes it can. In the meantime, the season continues. This weekend, Beitar Jerusalem plays Tel Aviv's Bnei Yehuda at home, and Nazareth goes against Hapoel Tel Aviv. For Only a Game, I'm Nahani Rouse in Beit She'an, Israel.
Every February, college football teams and high school prospects knit together their fates on National Signing Day. But not all the players who sign can look forward to joining their classmates on campus in the fall. Some will be gray-shirted as their chosen teams take advantage of an increasingly popular loophole in the NCAA rules. Barry Spraluga penned an article about gray-shirting for the Washington Post this week, and he joins us now from the NPR studios in Washington. Barry, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks very much, Bill.
Most fans of college sports are probably familiar with red-shirting, but what exactly is gray-shirting?
It's kind of an elaborate version of red-shirting. Red-shirting is the typical year off when a player arrives on campus, participates in practice, learns whatever system the coach has in place, but does not play in games against other schools. It's used to kind of mature them physically and mentally and make them more advanced when they do take the field. Gray shirting takes it another step. Gray shirts sign with a team in February, say in football, take the summer to work out, don't report to school in August or September with the rest of their classmates, take an entire semester off, maybe working at a part-time job or taking a class at a junior college or something like that, and then come to school in January. The idea is that they're another year more physically mature. They'll still have five full football seasons in which to play for intercollegiate competition, and you end up with trading basically potentially an 18-year-old freshman who's not ready to play very much for, at the back end, a 23- or 24-year-old man who's much more equipped to deal with the rigors of competition.
For the article that you wrote, you talked to a fellow named Dan Gronkowski, a suburban Buffalo player who was gray-shirted for his first semester at the University of Maryland, and his father, Gordon, told you that he hopes that his son's 5.5 years of eligibility for a football scholarship might put him on the road to a master's degree. Given the graduation rates for most college athletes, particularly at places like the University of Maryland, is this a realistic dream?
It's a realistic dream in very specific cases. Gordon Gronkowski played football at Syracuse University, and he seems to have a pretty good grasp on the fact that not very many high school players end up in the NFL, and that that's a dream that's worth having, but it's not a very realistic one. So he's, in effect, looking to take advantage of the system. He can get his kid into school at Maryland in January, where athletically the advantages are that he'll be able to go through spring practice in the spring of 2004, fall practice in the fall of 2004, spring practice in the spring of 2005, eventually end up on the field that fall, a more physically ready kid, and then be already a year and a half toward a degree. Now, if he completes his degree in 4 years, he'll have another year and a half to play with on scholarship that maybe he would use toward a master's. I don't think that's a mass. You're not going to see that happening on a mass level, but if a kid and a parent are smart enough to use the system that way, they certainly could end up with that.
The system seems to me it only works because some number of senior athletes don't come back to campus after the football season is over. Are all prospects who agree to gray shirt guaranteed scholarships when they reach campus, and are seniors encouraged to skip that final semester to open those slots up?
A lot of times you'll have you might have a fifth-year senior who is redshirted. So in essence, you know, a normal college student is expected to complete school in 4 years. A redshirt has 5 years to do that. So maybe he would play that fifth year of football in the fall of, say, the fall of 2003, and then already have completed his degree and either, you know, graduate in December and be free for that following spring, thus freeing up a scholarship for a gray shirt to come in. But there are potential problems where if a kid who is expecting to gray shirt hasn't signed his letter of intent, which is the form required by the NCAA that binds a student to a school and a school to a student. If he hasn't signed that, then if a kid gets caught up in the numbers game, he could be left without a scholarship. Now, coaches say that they have to police themselves, and if a college coach did this to a player, other college coaches would jump on it and say, hey, you can't trust that coach. He did this to this guy. You can trust us. Come play for us. So it's almost a self-policing type of thing.
Are there any statistics that suggest that young men who come into college or come to university on this gray shirting plan graduate at any greater rate than those who come in just for 4 years?
The NCAA doesn't track this process. Actually, when I called the NCAA to ask about what the numbers might be, they had never really even heard of the process referred to as gray shirting. Now, they were able to find the rule that allowed it to happen, but there's really no more than anecdotal evidence on how this works. And it, like I said, it's not like 20 kids a year at a school are doing this, but it has been used for the past 7 or 8 years at various schools coast to coast for a handful of players.
See, it sounds to me as if as gray shirting becomes more popular, which I guess if programs doing it succeed, it will, college football just becomes even more obviously a pro sport than it has been in the past.
That's certainly the perception. And I don't think among college coaches they're concerned about that. They argue, you know, it's great for the education of a kid if you use the Gronkowskis as a model. And that's probably what college coaches would like to have as the model out there. Look, a kid's getting to not only get one degree, but get on his way to another. But I'm not sure in practice that that's always going to be the case.
Another kind of trend that might be interesting to follow is whether gray-shirted players are more likely to become pros in the NFL. We're looking at Ronald Smith, who was the first gray shirt in the Pac-10 in 1996. He's now in his second year with the Minnesota Vikings. To what extent does he become a kind of a blueprint?
I think that he actually is more of an anomaly than the blueprint for the future. Obviously, I think, you know, at Washington State where he went, the coaches could say, look, we had this kid gray shirt and he made it to the NFL. You could too. But I think really it's done more often with recruits that maybe are on the fringe of a recruiting class, not the most highly sought after guys. In that sense, you're probably dealing with a lot more kids that are not the highest, you know, the most sought-after recruits and therefore probably not the biggest NFL prospects.
Barry, in the early going, as far as gray shirting is concerned, are we seeing one coach who's emerged as a mastermind at using this particular gimmick?
Kansas State seems to have done it a lot. There seems to be isolated places. Washington State has done it. In general, it seems like it's more of a Western phenomenon than really in the East. In the Atlantic Coast Conference and the Big East, there are some examples of it, but it doesn't seem to be really widespread. When I called coaches and people in athletic departments, say in the Atlantic Coast Conference, some of them really didn't have any idea what it was. There has been increasing early enrollment by kids who graduate from high school in 3.5 years and then show up in college during what would in effect be the spring of their senior year of high school and begin practice then. But this gray shirting process seems to have been a little bit slower to catch on.
Barry Sperluga writes for The Washington Post. Barry, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks very much, Bill. I appreciate it.
On Sunday in New York City, just 6 months after undergoing double bypass surgery, Ranulf Fiennes, 59, finished the last of 7 marathons in 7 days on 7 continents. Mr. Fiennes was joined by Mike Stroud, his longtime companion on adventures ranging from mountain climbing to polar circumnavigation of the globe. The marathoning began on a course in southern Chile that runs along the waters of the Magellan Strait. 26-mile runs in the Falkland Islands, Sydney, Singapore, London, and Cairo followed in unimaginably rapid succession. Finally, the pair headed to New York City, where they ran the New York Marathon, the only organized race on their itinerary. Mark Stroud carried a mini defibrillator with him just in case Ranulf Fiennes should suffer a heart problem, but it was Stroud who needed the medical attention. He lost the nail on one of his big toes. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment. On the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan & Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Cub fans dance on Wayland Avenue.
Reverse the curse, Bailey!
The Bulls basketball dynasty begins with a shot.
Here's Michael at the foul line. A shot on Elo. The Bulls win it!
Can't come up with anything for the Blackhawks or White Sox at the moment. I'm Scott Simon. Tune in for Chicago sports. And maybe sports from beyond. And, oh, right, we almost forgot the news on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's NBA action, Washington whipped Toronto 86-60. New York stymied Sacramento 114-111. Minnesota debunked the Magic of Orlando. The score was 100-71 in favor of the Timberwolves. Detroit beat Milwaukee 105-99. Golden State foiled Utah 95-89. New Jersey bested Boston 94-87, and the Clippers edged the Nuggets 104-102 in overtime. Elsewhere, Indiana prevailed over Cleveland 91-90. New Orleans bounced the Lakers 114-95. Philly foiled Chicago 106-85, Phoenix topped Memphis 96-88, and Seattle pummeled Portland 100-82. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a fast pastime for those who despise lawn care. But first, our look at the week's sports news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
We're more than halfway through the NFL season, and there's no football in this show. You want to talk about football?
Sure. Steve McNair of the Tennessee Titans is your half-season MVP.
Mm-hmm.
The New England Patriots of your hometown are the surprise of the NFL thus far. And the AFC North may be the worst division in the history of professional sports. Wrapping that up, let's move on.
Quick and useful summary, I'm sure. The college basketball season will open with the number one men's team and the number one women's team occupying the same campus. Does this suggest to you that Groucho Marx may have been way ahead of his time?
Exactly right. They're developing a university that both their basketball teams can be proud of. This would work out so much better if the two coaches spoke to each other.
Yeah, yeah. Although they are making efforts to make nice.
Hi, Jim. Right, hi, Gino.
Exactly.
Hi, Jim.
The Lakers are the scourge of the courts, the hard courts anyway. They're off to a strong start. But would anybody have thought that after Thursday night's game against the Spurs, Shaq and Kobe would be hugging?
That's all a lie. Don't believe a single moment of that embrace is anything. But, boy, are we glad we beat the Spurs without Tim Duncan in double overtime. They'll get back to disliking each other by, next Thursday.
Fans of pro basketball back when a little guy had a chance may be interested to know that Bob Cousy's memorabilia collection is up at auction, Charlie. Apparently Mr. Cousy's children are all teachers and guidance counselors, so he wants to help send his grandchildren to college. Will you be bidding?
If I were want to do such things, I would. Bob Cousy, first of all, is a wonderful man, and second of all, was the hero of my youth. And yes, I mean, if I had $15,000 for the lithograph of the 50 greatest players, but some of the items that are online, his uniform from the 1952 All-Star game, which would be fascinating, but also a collection of 2,500 canceled checks bearing his signature. Star Market, $12.95. Bob Cousy.
Must sell.
If you could get me a check that wasn't canceled, then I'd bid on it.
Yeah, yeah. The fact that he only had one championship ring was interesting, and he explained that by saying, Red came up with other trinkets and baubles, although the other times we won. Necklaces for the wives and stuff
like
that. Yeah,
this was before things got rather formalized.
Gordie Howe probably wished this week that the New York Rangers hadn't signed Mark Messier this season, Charlie, unless Mr. Howe is more gracious than most athletes are when somebody slips by them on the scoring list. Messier is second now.
It's an interesting kind of confluence of events because Mark Messier is really the last player around of the generation who grew up idolizing Gordie Howe, who played for
right.
a long time.
Right.
So I think there's a certain passing of the torch here that might not have occurred had we been 10 or 15 years down the line with another player.
Charlie, in the off-season baseball news, the Yankees have shed themselves of pitcher David Wells, and they've brought Don Mattingly back as a hitting coach. Why is all the news about the Yankees? They didn't even win. What are the world champion Marlins up to in the offseason?
So far, they're not tearing themselves apart, which is what happened the last time the Marlins won a world championship. Of course, I don't trust Marlin owner Jeffrey Loria as far as I can throw Pearl Player Stadium. So we'll see what goes on as we go along. The Yankees are interesting because having gotten rid of David Wells, Andy Pettit is a model of discontent right now and is probably going to want $50 million over 4 years. He's already 31 years old. He's not happy with the way pitching coach Mel Stottlemyle and aging lawn gargoyle Don Zimmer were treated. There seems to be some interest in Andy Pettit around baseball. If they do not keep Andy Pettit, their starting rotation is Mike Mussina and then a drop off the cliff.
New Hampshire will get a new AA baseball team this spring, Charlie. The Eastern League team is very, very well named, I think. What do you think?
Well, this is terrific. The only thing left, of course, is that will they be the Manchester primaries or the New Hampshire primaries?
Well, they've got to be the New Hampshire primaries.
They do have to be the New Hampshire primaries.
The knock on the men's side of the pro tennis tour has always been that all the players are dull. But Andy Roddick seems determined to dispel that image with the help of the TV industry. Are we ready for reality Roddick?
Yes, they're going to follow him around. He's also dating Mandy Moore, who is purportedly a pop star. Purportedly a pop star, those of us with young daughters. So they're going to follow him around. I guarantee you they're not going to follow him all the way around, although Andy, in the parlance of those of us who are familiar with and do get down with young people, he is, quote, totally amped for this show.
The realignment of the Big East Conference is, I gather, likely to confuse young scholars trying to get a grip on U.S. geography. This is not exactly unprecedented in either college or pro sports.
No, since the Louisiana Purchase, Louisville and Cincinnati have been East. But, of course, I look at all developments in sports as how does it affect me, only a game analyst. And what this means is I get to see the Marquette Fighting Warriors slash Golden Eagles a couple times a year because they'll be coming out to play Providence in Connecticut and so forth.
And they'll have a little Charlie Pierce seat, I'm sure, designated somewhere right behind the bench.
Absolutely, and a balcony from which I can throw money to the peasants.
A tip of the sun visor to Raffaello Legovello, Charlie. This week she finished a 4,455-mile windsurfing trip across the Pacific Ocean. What do you suppose the folks gathered around Martinique's Papeete Harbor made of her when she came ashore?
Well, I hope they could distinguish her from what is undoubtedly a crowd of 8,000 other windsurfers who just sort of ply the harbor every
day. We're there anyway, yeah.
She followed the route made famous by Thord Heyerdahl in that book Kon-Tiki that we all read when we were 12.
I remember it well. A record requiring less endurance was set by a Seattle man named Mike Rennie this week. He had more competition, however, than Miss Javello did.
He did. He is now the best screwdriver in North America. Insert joke here. But apparently this has a lot to do with Chevy trucks and DeWalt. And I don't think there's any question that Mike Rennie may well be the most sought-after pit crew member on the NASCAR circuit next year if he does put himself up for free agency. He sank 5 screws in 7.6 seconds, and he won $25,000 on a pickup truck.
Is there anything for which there is not a record?
No, absolutely not.
Okay. Finally, in the updated version of one of those races that used to pit a man against a horse for the entertainment of practically everybody, Michael Schumacher is set to race his Ferrari against a fighter jet. What do you think, the car or the plane?
Would I be confirming your worst suspicions about where we are as a people by pointing out that this is not unprecedented either? Tazio Nuvolari in 1931 raced an Alfa Romeo against a biplane and got whipped, but in 1981, Gilles Villeneuve won back the title for those of us who drive automobiles and not fighter jets by beating an F-104 over a kilometer in his Ferrari. So depending on where you're gambling, the automotive world has a one-game winning streak over the fighter jet world.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine and joins me each week at this time for fast-paced analysis. Thank you, Charlie.
Of course, if they can use the missiles, that winning streak may come to an end.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Ask any NASCAR fan what's so special about cars going around in circles, and he or she will tell you it's about speed, noise, and risk. Stock car racing's lightning spectacle has drawn millions to the stands at Talladega and Indy, but a growing number of average Joes who dream of turning their own laps in America's fastest-growing sport but don't have the tens of thousands of dollars to sink into a world-class race car are turning to a more affordable four-wheeled vehicle. Only a Game's Kim Green motored to Hohenwald, Tennessee to check out America's fastest mowing sport.
On a brilliant October Saturday in sleepy Hohenwald, Tennessee, a host of trailers converges upon Lewis County Memorial Park with plates from as far away as Michigan, Florida, and Texas. Each bears a riding lawnmower, blade-free and souped up for racing.
RPM check. This is in the IMO class, and we're limited to 36.
69-year-old Dave Hurdle okays a flashy lime green machine belonging to Mark Rowling, the first in a long line of nervous sodsters in pit row hoping to pass his tech inspection. Hurdle says racers take safety, if nothing else, very seriously.
Because you can see they check brakes, they check the kill switch. We all have to have a tether, so if we fall off, the engine quits.
Hurdle races in the IMO class, which stands for International Mower of Weeds, and represents an abridgment of homespun turf existentialism. I mow, therefore I am. IMO is one of four mower classes ranging from ordinary stock machines right out of your garage to the anything-goes factory experimental class. Some of these vehicles reach speeds of 60 miles an hour. Hurdle says inverting one is no joke.
Early this year, I broke an axle on the IMO, and I flipped just beautiful. I went flying. I did manage to get out of the way of the machine.
And then I guess that you could say you got mowed down.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, that would be right.
In the pits, a pair of red and white cowboy boots that mutate into sneakers at the foot issue from beneath a sumptuous 1979 MTD with vermilion hood flames. The richly shoed Charles Powell, who races as Mr. Mojangles, reflects on the absurdity of today's event.
So it's always fun to get in a car and drive, 750 miles... and then work on your mower. My mower at home that I cut the grass with don't even work.
If you haven't figured it out already, Powell hails from Texas. His bull riding days abruptly ended once he noticed a lawnmower race on TV a few years ago. His kids bought him a racing suit, and it was Katie Barr the mower. He sees mowing lawns as a waste of an exquisite machine.
I think that a man's not supposed to cut grass. Not with a riding lawnmower anyway. Maybe with a push mower. But riding lawnmowers, they're made for racing.
So these things have been misused for years.
Yes. Someone knew what they was doing when they developed them and built them. It's just they built them for the wrong purpose.
Yeah, they put blade stuff on them.
Those blades mess them up.
Fashion runs amok in the pits. Nearby, a man arrayed in a splendid full-body fireproof Nomex racing suit with black and white swirls cuts an impressive figure.
You have a nice outfit on.
Well, thank you. I just got this set up last year.
U.S. LMRA Race Commissioner Ken Jones stands ready to mow beside Mowishener, his 1968 Sheridan Huffy, emblazoned with colorful sponsorship logos. He and other lawnmower jockeys would have you believe it's all about the racing, but really, it's about love.
With this here, we run a live axle in the back. It runs a lawnmower transmission, which is a 700 Peerless. It runs a chain drive on the output shaft to the rear axle. We do gearing there, and then the motor has a lot of internal motor work done to it to make it really go fast.
Bored and stroked?
Yep. It's about a 40-plus mile an hour mower.
Full race camps?
Yep.
Most of these racers are machinists, mechanics, or equipment salesmen, gear geeks who love being under the mower even more than giving it some shoe on the track. They'll spend hundreds of hours shimming valves or grinding camshafts, sometimes alone, more often with friends or with a son or daughter. And then there's the road trip itself, in which the family packs up for the weekend and heads across the nation to visit the extended family.
What every racer here looks forward to is that traveling to a race and seeing all their friends. You could walk around and ask anybody here, we're all like a family, and it's like a reunion when we come to a race.
And there's a little bit of a party afterward, I hear.
We do a little scolin'.
There's no scolin' in evidence yet, as the qualifying heats draw to a close. The 20-lap feature races all begin Le Mans style. Drivers in boots, long pants, gloves, and full-face helmets sprint across the track, jump on their mowers, and pray as they yank the cords.
Ready, set, and they're off. Let's see who's first. Get off the line.
With the dirt track dialed in, dust clouds drift across a crowd of several hundred onlookers. Three old-timers from Hohenwald look suitably impressed.
I like them. I've been before. I love them.
What do you like about them?
The speed.
I can't tell if they're kidding. But one thing's for sure. It takes guts to rocket around a dirt track padded by a few hay bales on a contraption that's not designed to bust a few miles an hour. In today's races, the rubber side mostly stays down. But every turf burner here has a story to tell about a painful hay bath.
We ain't no powder puff.
Janet Witt is a tiny woman sporting a white do-rag festooned with the common flame theme. She's running her first race today in a faster class, despite nursing a broken collarbone. Witt likes the adrenaline rush she gets riding low groove in a pack of Blade Runners. She says racing's actually good for her health. A recent cancer survivor, race weekends give her something to get excited about and a sense of community.
These racers and these fan or the support of the racers during all this has been just fantastic. They have called, they have emailed, they write, they send cards. It's just, I couldn't have done it without them. It's just been wonderful. It's what keeps me going.
Number four, all the way from Florida, banged up, wrapped up. You can't do nothing but love the girl, Janet Witt. Janet Witt was U.S. LMRA 2003 Driver of the Year, ladies and gentlemen.
Witt and around 30 other racers take home trophies today, along with points toward the national points race that ends next fall. There may not be any money, fame, or glory in lawnmower racing, but to anyone who can transform a hated chore into an exciting competitive motorsport, I say, you reap what you mow. For Only a Game, I'm Kim Green in Hohenwald, Tennessee.
Let's go!
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from Linda Gradstein, Sean Cole, George Hicks, David Kenny, and Hal Humphreys. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or perhaps check out action photos of Bobby Cleveland's Monster Mower and other custom lawn machines. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from lawnmower racing chief steward Steve Bertrand, who warns of lawnmower racing's danger.
We do ask that you take the blades off. Like they say, you know, everybody likes to eat sausage, but nobody wants to see it made. Well, you'd be seeing it made if you dumped a mower over with the blades on it.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, that's motivation for lawnmower racers to keep their blades on. I mean, you win all the races and you have plenty to eat. I'm Phil Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.